Oh yes, and it is beautiful Friday the 13th, which hopefully none of you have triskaidekaphobia, which if you didn't know, that's the technical word for fear of the number 13, at least if the Charlie Brown special's got the terminology right. Ah, and I seem to recall earlier than I did in the other section this time, that I had a question that I left you all with over the weekend. Which was, if you had a carboxylic acid that has an oxygen that's part of the carbonyl and an oxygen that's not part of the carbonyl, just to get it out of the way, Dante,
yes,
why is it that it's the carbonyl oxygen that does get protonated and not the single bond oxygen?
Mm-hmm.
So nothing happens. If versus if you recall, which I'm not going to write it out again today because we're going to see the reverse mechanism instead. But if you recall, when we protonate the carbonyl, that carbonyl can open. That's a form of delocalization. And you could even have this single bond oxygen then stabilize that carbocation. But if we had this single bond oxygen protonate in the first place, then yeah, you make an ion out of it. But there's nothing we can do to stabilize it. Even if we allowed resonance to happen, that would put a second positive charge on the oxygen, be horribly unfavorable. So there's no stabilization of this anion, so it's even less likely to form than protonation of the carbonyl. So what I'd like to start with today is the reverse mechanism of making the ester. So we saw Fischer esterification, which is a reversible cationic acid catalyzed mechanism. We're going to see the reverse, which by the principle microscopic reversibility is going to be step-by-step reversible or identical to esterification, just everything backwards. Before we do that, though, very brief note about nomenclature. So at least we can have carboxylic acids and esters that we could name. And I'll start with carboxylic acids first. We, of course, know this as acetic acid, but that's its common name. The more IUPAC-style name, which we name things by numbers, this would be ethanoic acid. So the oic acid is the standard ending. For carboxylic acids. Because many, many carboxylic acids have a biological source, many carboxylic acids have common names. If you look at the back of many of your shampoo bottles, if you see anything with laurate, palmitate, myristate, laureth sulfate. All these are different long-chain carboxylic acids that have been derivatized. And we'll talk in a minute about what a soap really is. The only other common name besides acetic acid that I want you to know for the moment is the one-carbon carboxylic acid. Formic acid. Also called its common or proper name, methanoic acid. So that's just brief introduction to nomenclature of acids. Now about esters. We name an ester by addressing the two main parts of a ester structure. What kind of alkyl group is attached to the oxygen, and then how many carbons are in the carboxylate portion. So think of this, that when you had nitric and sulfuric and all these other acid names that you learned in Chem 1A, when you made the counter ion, like nitric acid deprotonates, then you make nitrate. If you have phosphoric, you have phosphate, ate ending. If you had acetic, then it turns into acetate. So same way, we have a carboxylic acid from which we get the term carboxylate, meaning the negatively charged portion of it. So we're going to name this as the alkyl group followed by the carboxylate. So this particular compound would be called propyl because of its alkyl group. And then either acetate, or it could be called propyl ethanoate. Anything else about nomenclature we'll get to some other day. I want to focus on mechanism today. But at least now when you're reading through the text and you see an ester name, you'd have a vague idea of how it's constructed. So let's look at, and let me just make sure I'm following the other section well enough. Yes, let's look at that reverse esterification. And as with many of the carboxylic acid examples I give in terms of mechanism, I'm often going to use ethyl acetate as my sample compound, just because it's a relatively small compound you have to write over and over and over and over again if you're doing a mechanism. So similar reasoning as we saw at the opening of class as to why is it that one versus the other of these positions is going to get protonated. Because if the carbonyl gets protonated, there is delocalization possible. Favorable delocalization possible. So our first step is to protonate. Notice the reverse reaction arrow. You must use reverse arrows for this reaction. And we'll talk about favoring products versus reactants after I show the mechanism. So you protonate. To retain that acronym, I show an open step, although it is possible to combine the first two steps together. If you had an arrow coming from the double bond to H+, remember the delocalization, that's just resonance, it's not really a reaction step. So if you ever combine resonance with something else, that's actually acceptable, and it's a shortcut mechanism. It just doesn't happen to fit this acronym anymore, so that's why I normally don't do it. So we have protonate, we have open. If we were trying to go from an ester back to carboxylic acid, we would make sure to flood the reaction, well, as much as we could and still keep everything soluble. We'd flood it with water. So water would be what would come in to attack at this point. And then we'd have a deprotonate step. Now the intermediate I just wrote is much like a hemiacetal or hemiketal. I don't actually recall the functional group name, And so what I suggested to the other sections is maybe this should be one of those questions I ask everybody, that it might be mentioned somewhere in the text, or maybe with just the bare minimum of Googling, Wikipedia, and blogging, tweeting, whatever you all do these days, you might be able to find the answer to what kind of functional group is this? It's one of two forms of questions I'll be asking, hoping that I'll get an answer on Tuesday. By the way, whatever the exact topic order ends up being and all the other dates that are going to be for the quarter, I want to at least announce that your first quiz will be not this Tuesday, but the Tuesday after that. So first time we meet during the third week of class. So at least you have one target that you know what to aim for. So part of the reason I'm making a big deal of this intermediate is that, like the hemiacetals and ketals, this is normally not isolatable, but we have three different oxygens that could potentially react right now. Reasonable question is, well, which one? The answer is all of them. There's not that much reactivity difference between any of the three oxygens, not much. But if either of the hydroxide OH groups were the ones that would react at this point, that would drive us back to the ester again. So that this reaction would go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth until eventually it's the ether portion, or what looks like an ether, that ends up getting protonated. You might say, well, how do we know the reaction's going to go forward then? Because we can change the reaction conditions to favor either going forward as we're presenting it here, going back to the carboxylic acid, or the way I'm going to express it is how to make the esterification happen, which we'll get to in just a second. So we have one more round here of protonate. And then open. And then we show the residence as the form of attack. And that's followed by one last deprotonate step. And just to be clear, I stopped showing it up above. But one of the end byproducts is that extra alcohol that used to be part of the ester. I point that out just anticipating that sometime soon we're going to start seeing more synthesis questions. And so if I gave you this ester as a starting material, realize that I'm giving you four carbons, not just the carboxylic acid, for you to do some synthesis with. Now, let's talk about favoring products, because if we now switch back to talking about esterification, not desterification, esters and carboxylic acids, they're very close to each other in reactivity. In fact, I think your textbook, someone points out, claims that esters are more reactive than carboxylic acids. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know if I've learned it backwards or if the text I used to use actually had it backwards. Point, though, is they are so close to each other in terms of thermodynamic stability that in an equilibrium situation like this, if you just had equal amounts of the two materials, you might not push the reaction much one way or the other. But esterification, you might recall, has water as one of its products. In fact, let me write out the set of conditions that are often used in real life to do a large-scale Fischer esterification. And so we can have some form of carboxylic acid which let's say I want to make the ethyl ester, so I'll use ethanol. Need an acid catalyst. Don't know if I told the story once or not, but this is just the type of thing that can happen in your brain when you're tired, but still part of it's functioning. Went home one evening after working grad school, made dinner, went to sleep, woke up the next morning. First thing I thought of when I woke up the next morning was, oops, forgot the acid catalyst. Because if you don't put the acid catalyst in, the reaction's not that favorable. And even though I've been cooking all night long and was hoping to walk in the next morning and do something with it, sure enough, I verified without that acid catalyst, not much happened. Now, one other thing that's often included in real life is toluene. You might think, why toluene? Well, we'll discuss that momentarily. Product's going to be an ethyl ester, but you also produce water. Now, it seems to me last quarter we discussed a piece of glassware that's sometimes used in reactions like this where water's produced. Because, and we'll do this as a really quick review because I don't want to do the big, long, nasty version of this topic today. But for those of you who've been with me for a while and you've been programmed to say this answer, what are the definitions of equilibrium? Same rate of the forward and reverse process. Can't see any change in the concentration of reactants and products. And delta G zero, which meaning no observable change in energy because you're already at the lowest energy point of the system. So if you were to remove water, well, the forward rate of reaction is still going to be what it was because the water is a product, but that means the reverse rate of reaction is going to drop because you removed a product, which means more product's going to be formed because the forward reaction keeps on going, and so you make more product. Energetically, we can analyze it and say that by removing a product, you effectively make the reactants a higher energy, which means it again reacts forward to lower the energy and makes more product. So in other words, whatever way we stress in equilibrium, the reaction is going to respond to undo that stress. We remove a product, more product forms. If we keep removing the product continuously, then the reaction never settles. The reaction continuously moves forward. And that's how, if these two things, the ester and the acid, if they were at the same energy, we can still make the reaction go forward if we just keep removing water as it happens. Does anybody remember the name of the device, the piece of glassware that we discussed that helped us do exactly this? We didn't actually use it last quarter. We did something like it, but we didn't use the piece of glassware itself. I think some of you are signaling you know what it looks like even. It's called a Dean Stark trap. Not something we're going to test you on unless we end up using it in lab, and then we'll talk about it more thoroughly, and then it would potentially be testable. But more just as a reminder. So you might have a setup somewhat like this, where you have your reaction flask at the bottom, Dean Stark trap in between the reflux condenser and that reaction flask. What happens is you heat this whole mixture up to the boiling point, which, given that you have ethanol, the ethanol is probably going to be the thing that boils at the lowest boiling point. Carboxylic acids, minor detail we'll come back to when we have time, tend to form dimers as pure compounds. The OH group from one interacts with the carbonyl of the other and vice versa. So that tends to make them have much higher boiling points than just plain alcohol. So this will boil significantly below the boiling point of water, or most likely will. And then as this boils, what reflux means is it heats up and then condenses on the side of that sidearm, falls back down, heats, falls down, heats, falls down. But some of it, as it's falling down, is going to get trapped in that sidearm just because it's physically falling down that piece of glassware. In the sidearm, if we blow up what it looks like, you'll have an accumulation of water and organic, which the blue I'm using to represent water, and the organic in red. I put the organic in top because generally, in esterifications, the two compounds you use and the product are all less dense than water. So what happens is over time, solution bubbles up, refluxes, recondenses, collects in the tube, water and the organic separate. The water is more dense, and so it collects at the bottom of that side trap. As the reaction keeps on going, both of the levels build, both of the water and the organic. Well, at some point, the organic will just end up spilling back in the reaction flask, which is great because in case the reaction wasn't done, then that reaction has a chance to keep on going. But since water never makes it back over, water is removed as a product, which is what's dragging the reaction to the right, which is what causes the product to form. The role of toluene is that it forms an azeotrope. An azeotrope is a vapor mixture which is made of two components that, if they were liquids, would be immiscible with each other. So in other words, water and toluene won't dissolve in each other, but for whatever bizarre reason, they do end up making some kind of solution with each other in the vapor phase. So as this reflux is going on, the toluene helps effectively remove water from solution. Once it recondenses again, water and toluene separate, and again you get that separation of layers. That sidearm generally on the nicer traps has a valve on it so you can drain the water out to help further ensure that it won't build up enough to splash back. Or the nice ones also generally have calibration marks to let you know the volume of water that's been collected so you have a chance of calculating how far in the reaction that you are. So that's the Dean Start track. And again, because that was a last quarter topic, I'm not going to test about this unless we do it in lab. But let me make a mention of this azeotrope aspect of toluene, because we hadn't discussed that before at all. So water and toluene form an azeotrope. Which is a vapor mixture of two or more compounds. That in the liquid phase are immiscible. Toluene is often added to refluxes as such as this to help assist the removal of water. Any questions on, even though we're not getting tested on it, on the Dean Stark apparatus or on the cationic mechanism that we saw today, the reverse esterification? Immiscible means not soluble, completely not soluble. Think of it as like mixable. Then I have a couple more over the weekend thought questions. These I really would want answers to on Tuesday. One of them is a test problem that used to show up without warning. Of course, they had an extensive discussion of mechanism. But just so that it gets your attention a little bit, imagine that you have a carboxylic acid that you reacted with an acid source, heat, and water, but not just any old water, isotopically labeled water. O18 is just an isotope, meaning it has a different number of neutrons than the standard oxygen. It's pricey stuff, but it's used in what are called labeling experiments. Because you can, with the right methods, track and trace regular oxygen versus oxygen 18. So what would happen if you were to extensively hydrate a carboxylic acid with an excess of oxygen 18 water? Now, don't answer now. It's for Tuesday. Similar or related question is if we take an ester and we react it with an alcohol that was not used to make the ester. And again, same type of thing. Alcohol, acid catalyst, heat, and time. What will we get? So, spent the first half of lecture on cationic reactions. Let's switch to anionic reactions. I want to now get into saponification. Which some of you might recognize that word or word that's related to it. What is related to this word saponification? Soap. If you mispronounce it a different way, sapon, sabon, savon. It's similar in some languages to the word for soap. And in fact, it's related to the old school way of making soap where you take lye, the stuff that's really caustic, really basic, mix it up with animal fat. It would decompose the animal fat and make carboxylic acid salts, or what are called carboxylate salts. And why is it that these carboxylates have any relationship to soap? Well, let's look at the example, an example molecule of something that could be used as soap. Now, last section I randomly wrote this compound up, not because of the exact number of carbons it had, but because it had a lot of them. It's 16 carbons, and I was blanking on its common name, but apparently it's palmitate. So we have laurate, which is 12, myristate, 14, palmitate, which is 16, and then stearate, which is 18. These, again, if you look at the back of shampoo bottles, you might see some of these names. Why is it that it's these long carboxylic acids that are often used as soaps? Well, does anybody happen to know the reason for that? Polarity, but you raised your hand. Go ahead. That's right. There's two portions of it that have contrasting solubilities. We have what's often called the head group, which is ionic. Because it's ionic, that means it's hydrophilic, compatible with water, But it also means it is lipophobic, meaning fat-fearing, meaning it doesn't like organic layers. You also then have this long, very non-polar tail. That because it's organic, it means it's hydrophobic, but therefore lipophilic. And when you take a compound like this and add it to water, once you reach a certain concentration called the CMC, the critical micelle concentration, well, I gave the word away, it makes a micelle. Which, if you're not familiar with that term, it's a structure composed of several molecules, in this case of the soap, where the polar head groups all migrate to the exterior of the structure, while the lipophilic tails, the organic portions, all end up on the interior. So if you have some aqueous solution that's got a bunch of grease in it, when you drop the soap in, the grease will be compatible with the tails, will end up on the interior of these micelles. But the outside surface of this whole structure is polar and therefore water compatible. So even though the interior is grease, the whole thing is able to float through water. That's how you clean grease out using soap. So that's why saponification historically was important, because it produced the compounds that could act in this way. Often, not this particular kind of compound, but things that do the same thing, where they have the split behavior, they're called surfactants, surface active agents, because they operate the interface between the organic and aqueous phases. Now that's what this, this is the connection to soap, but let's see the reaction mechanism itself. Is it? Inverse micelles, where the water forms the interior and the organic forms the exterior. That's all based on polarity, that it's not a chemical reaction, it's just the way things congregate in water. But now let's see the reaction mechanism, which both this and the mechanism we've already seen, the cationic one, are meant to be good examples of all the other reactions we're soon going to be getting. And there's two key portions of this particular mechanism, the saponification. Because part of the saponification reaction is technically reversible, and you need to know it's reversible and why it's reversible. And part of it is absolutely not reversible, and you need to know when and why it's not reversible. Because the same places in the reaction we're going to evaluate when we use things like Grignard reagents. Saponification is where we use sodium hydroxide, a strong base. Grignard reagent is just a stronger base. Otherwise, the mechanisms have a lot of similarity. How does the mechanism start? Well, I just told you that hydroxide is the main reagent in saponification. And really, there's only one thing useful that can happen between hydroxide and some kind of carbonyl compound, which is to attack the carbonyl itself. Now, last section, when I asked what could happen with these two compounds, the essentially correct answer was SN2. The idea behind it was correct, in that hydroxide was going to displace something. But I'm going to show this as opening up the carbonyl first, because this term tetrahedral intermediate came up in the other section again. And I have not read the book my own self, I'll admit that, but I bet you if we were to go look, we'll find something about the tetrahedral intermediate in there. So if you're asking why did I not show this ethoxide group being kicked out at the same time, the answer is read the book, and we'll talk about it Tuesday. So, but the big deal here is look that I'm using a reversible arrow. And there's a very good reason why. Because we could compare some pKa values. Now, I scared the crap out of the other section because it's been enough days since it was just the first day of the quarter and I'm already spacing on which section did what. Because they didn't get the pre-lab love that you all got on Tuesday. They didn't get the lecture in aldol condensation. So when I looked at them funny and said, what's the pKa of an aldehyde? They're like, I don't know, you tell us. But you should know, right? What is the pKa? Don't look at your notes. What is the pKa of an aldehyde? Mm-hmm. And what is the pKa of a ketone? Mm-hmm. You mean you had all that playtime when I wasn't here yesterday? That I know that you all were so dedicated that all you did was O-chem, because even if you couldn't be here, you had that much O-chem love in your heart that you still studied while I wasn't here. They're looking at me like, oh, stop it, Dr. Ray. I guess we hadn't memorized our five main carboxylic acid derivatives, acyl halides, esters, carboxylic acids, amides, to know which one in which order of reactivity should be, even though I already hinted to you that was going to be one of the questions on the quiz. We're not falling behind like I am, or do as I say, not as I do. I may be already a cold quarter behind, but it doesn't mean you need to be. Anyways, just reminder that you need to know your pKa values, because I'm going to add some to this list that we were generating. Does anybody know the pKa of water itself? 15.7. Which, as a side note, that is the Ka, the pKw, I should say, of water, which is 14, multiplied by the log of 55, which is the molarity of water. Just a side note. That's plain old water. How about a primary alcohol in solution, roughly? What is its pKa? 16. For reasons that we'll talk about next time when we have the time, in solution, less substituted alcohols tend to be slightly more acidic than more substituted alcohols. So something like ethanol is a pKa of 18, where something like T-butanol is more like a pKa of 18. But the point being is hydroxide and this alkoxide that we just made are not that different from each other in terms of how basic they are, because their parent acids are not that different from each other either. Well, if they're not that different from each other, then why does it want to be one of these versus the other? Couldn't this negative charge just kick the hydroxide back out? And in theory, yes. And that's why this step of the reaction is reversible. But what would happen if this carbonyl tried to reform? And instead of hydroxide, it kicks the ethoxide out, which ethoxide is slightly more basic than hydroxide, because hydroxide's parent is more acidic than ethanol is. But if it does get kicked off, now something else happens. We have a reaction that's no longer directly because of the carbonyl. It is indirectly, though, because we just made an acid, but we also simultaneously made a base. So before anything else is really possible, an instant acid-base neutralization is going to occur. So let me put two stars on here to show the two places in the mechanism that we need to pay particular attention to. The first, as I had said, was where the reaction is reversible. So the first portion of this mechanism is technically reversible, since the base used in the intermediate formed are similar enough to each other in terms of basicity. I will say practically the same statement again when we do get to something like the Grignard reaction, only there the difference between bases is going to be dramatic. And so then the reaction will be irreversible. We do have irreversibility that turns up in this case, and that's at the end of this process, because at the end of the mechanism, both an acid and a base are formed. Which instantly react with each other and prevent the reaction from being reversible. So let me summarize what we've done the first 2 days in this chapter. We talked about different carboxylic acid derivatives. We talked about the two ways in which they differ in reactivity. We talked about induction or resonance. We talked about leaving group ability. I then made the statement that because they're carbonyl compounds, these carboxylic acid derivatives tend to have two flavors of reaction, cationic and anionic. Cationic, where they're generally stepwise and acid-catalyzed, anionic, where they're generally concerted and base-promoted. Esterification, deesterification was our example of a reversible cationic reaction. Saponification was our example of an anionic reaction. We've seen how to go back and forth between carboxylic acids and esters, and we've seen how in certain cases there can be both a cationic and anionic version of a reaction. To go from an ester to an acid, we saw. We could use water and acid, or we can use sodium hydroxide. But we've also seen that carboxylic acids themselves can break these patterns of reactivity because the carboxylic acid itself is acidic. So for example, even though we could successfully use a cationic mechanism to produce an ester, so we took a carboxylic acid, an alcohol, and an acid catalyst. We've seen how that kind of reaction occurs. But if we tried to take the basic version of that reagent using an alkoxide instead, the only thing that will happen is neutralization, which you can't see because it's off the page here. But esterification is not possible. due to the fact that neutralization will happen first. Acid-base reactions are generally some of the fastest reactions that can occur. So throw the set of reagents together before the alkoxide has a chance to attack the carbonyl, it just rips the hydrogen off, reaction's over with. Now I know we're over, but let me show you the one last reaction that I squeezed in the other section. And that's the one exception to this. It is an anionic method for making esters. And it's using a very special reagent known as diazomethane. Diazomethane is so useful because it can produce a methyl ester specifically, but with practically quantitative yield. Quantitative yield means 100% yield, means every mole that reacts is successful. That's as long as you can keep the whole thing from blowing up. Because diazomethane is a very, 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 very reactive compound. Why all the varies in there? Well, look at the structure of it. It is nitrogen gas trapped on the carbon, effectively. And so this rapidly can decompose to form a very reactive intermediate called a carbene, CH2 neutral, which if you only had two hydrogens on carbon, it is neutral, but it's highly reactive, and it's a type of chemistry we haven't talked about yet. But you make that and nitrogen gas if this falls apart. Now, you can avoid it blowing up, usually, by using specially coated glassware, plastic or Teflon coated. Why? Because the little cracks that are in any kind of glass apparently are enough and the right environment for this to start to decompose and initiate that explosion. But if it doesn't explode, it undergoes this reaction mechanism. Having a carbanion in it, it's very basic. And so exposed to carboxylic acid, you get exactly that kind of neutralization reaction I said you should expect. But you now have a methyl group, which is normally an excellent substrate for SN2, and you have nitrogen gas, which is an excellent leaving group. And even though a carboxylic acid is not that basic, you'll get SN2 occurring. Which means you make the methyl ester and nitrogen gas that bubbles off as a byproduct. Any questions before we wrap up for the weekend?